Attempt to go to Vrindavan. Last week, the residents of Kalinagram, this is after when the devotees are leaving after having spent 4 months or so in Jagannath Puri with Mahaprabhu. And their parting as they were going back to Bengal, and Mahaprabhu was staying in Jagannath Puri, was always very touching. And one year, the devotees asked from Kulinagram, which is near the border of Orissa, I have heard from Prabhu. So they asked Prabhu, what is the sadhana that I should do? What should be my sadhana? What should be my duty and how I should execute it? So Mahaprabhu's reply was very important. Vaishnava seva, nama, sankirtan, duikara. These two things, serving the devotees, the Vaishnavas, and chanting the holy name always. And then these two things, Sigra Bhave Sri Krishna Charan. Very easily one will attain the lotus feet of Krishna. It's very simple to understand and not so simple to do. Why isn't it simple for us to just serve the Vaishnavas and chant the holy names of Krishna continuously? You ask yourself, why isn't it easy to do? So many reasons. But the essential, in essence, the reason, the general reason is rajagun, tamagun, passion and ignorance. That the mind is filled with so many desires, and secondarily, the mind just doesn't have the positive energy to take shelter of Krishna in this way and to be with Krishna. So, after hearing this, that there should be Vaishnava Seva, the inhabitants of Kalinagram asked, let us know who is actually a Vaishnava and what his symptoms are. Who are the actual devotees of Vishnu? And understanding his mind, this resident of Kalina who asked this question, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu smiled and he gave the following reply. And we read this reply into the Prabhupada's quite lengthy purport last week. He said, a person, this is Mahaprabhu's reply, a person who always chants the holy name of the Lord is to be considered a first-class Vaishnava. And your duty is to serve his lotus feet. Then, the following year, so this went on for 2 years, the devotees came to see Mahaprabhu and stayed for the time of the Rath Yatra and for some months after. Then they again left. So the second time they were leaving, the devotees of Kalinagram, who must have been thinking about this question for all the year, they asked again the Lord the same question. And hearing this question, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu again taught them about the different types of Vaishnavas. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, a first-class Vaishnava, so last year, what did he say? Previous year, what did he say? How did he define a first-class devotee?
Was constantly chanting.
Constantly chanting. And this time he says, a first class Vaishnava, yaha darshanamukhi vaise krishnam, that immediately Krishna's name comes to you. Taha janiha tumi Vaishnava pradhan. This is Vaishnava pradhan. This is the topmost Vaishnava. So Mahaprabhu said, a first class Vaishnava is he whose very presence, when you're in his presence, it makes others chant the holy name of Krishna. And so Prabhupada in his purport, also a little bit long, and it's the last long purport for quite a while, he explains the different kinds of Vaishnavas. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that if an observer immediately remembers the holy name of Krishna upon seeing Vaishnava, that Vaishnava should be considered a Mahabhagavata, a first class devotee, Vaishnava Pradhan. Such a Vaishnava is always aware of his Krishna conscious duty, and he is enlightened in self realization. He's always aware of his Krishna conscious duty, what his service is to Krishna, and he is enlightened in self-realization. Now, the word enlightened in English is very interesting because it means it gives light. That is, his concept of his self-realization is enlightened. And the opposite of enlightened is in darkened. Someone is in deep darkness. So it's clear what is meant by this expression, that in darkness, if all the lights were off in the room, we couldn't see anything. And if we couldn't see anything, we wouldn't understand, practically speaking, anything about the room. Of course, unless we heard a great roar or something, then we would understand that we have to leave very quickly. But to understand self-realization, the consciousness cannot remain in darkness. It has to be enlightened. And then one could see. See what? Well, completely enlightened. He is enlightened in self-realization. There are no shadows left in his consciousness. There are no dark spots in his consciousness about who he is. So he doesn't only see himself as eternal, which is a partial lightening of the consciousness. He sees himself as he understands that he's eternal. Just as if we think that we were the same person that we were when we were in a child's body, we were clearly the same person. There is an obvious, everyone knows it, a continuity of identity. It was me who was in the first grade. It was me who was in the third grade. It was me who was in the 10th standard. It was me who went to high school. It was me who went to university. It was me who did this. It was me who did that. Up to the present, all these different identities, and I remain constant. All these, throughout all the different changes of bodies, I remain the same. My intelligence grew, my mind changed, but I was the same person. So we can understand from that quite clearly that there is something, who I am, that never changes. So one could also assume that that something that never changed throughout all the changes of body won't change when the great change of bodies comes, at the time of death, at the time of birth. These two great, the greatest changes of bodies. So in this way, one can be partially self-realized and understand, yes, I never change. In the past, I was always me. In the future, I'll always be me. In the present, I'm always me. And this is partial self-realization. The eternality of me, of my identity, the eternality of the soul. But complete, more complete self-realization is when we understand we are eternal, but we understand ourself in relationship to the supreme eternal, to Krishna, the absolute truth. And what is our relationship? That we are eternally preserved. Krishna of Krishna Nityadas. Eternally we are servants of Krishna. So we are eternal, but we're more than just eternal, we're eternally servants of Krishna. So when we're awake in that relationship, fully awake in that relationship, when our consciousness is enlightened, so we see ourselves, this is called sambandhagyan, you know, we see our relationship with Krishna, when that is our, when we think of ourselves, we think of ourselves as Krishna's servant eternally, and we know who we are, we know what our service is, then that is full enlightenment. So the first class Vaishnava, he's always aware of his Krishna conscious duty, knows what his service is, and he's enlightened in self-realization. He knows he's Krishna's servant, those two things. He knows he's Krishna's servant, and he knows what his duty is, his service is to Krishna. So in this world, he may have one duty, a fully self-enlightened, self-realized person, and in the spiritual world he may have a different duty, but it's always in relationship to serving Krishna. He is always in love with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, and this love is without adulteration. What does adulteration mean? He loves Krishna and there's no adulteration. Does that mean that he's a child and not adult? He hasn't been made adult? He hasn't been made, no, doesn't mean that. What does adulteration mean? Yeah, there's no mixtures of anything else other than his loving relationship with Krishna. Prabhupada termed that unalloyed devotional service. So what is it like to be an unalloyed devotee of Krishna, a pure devotee of Krishna, that one is in his consciousness, is enlightened in his relationship with Krishna, that he loves Krishna, and he has no desires external to that loving relationship with Krishna. How does Krishna reciprocate with such souls? What is his thinking? What are his realizations? What is he attached to? What is he averse to? So this is, that of course will be an interesting discussion. But in its topmost form, if we read the pastimes of Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna, that's exactly what we hear about in Vrindavan. How Krishna is dealing with these pure devotees, but not only pure devotees, but pure devotees who love him in the topmost mood, in the most special, sweet mood that the residents of Vrindavan love him with. And those pure souls experience the highest ecstasy. Now, what is the highest ecstasy like? Of course, not only I can't say because I don't know, but I've heard such wonderful things about the sweetest and highest ecstasy. I've heard that it makes the happiness of Brahman, this is in the words of Srila Rupa Goswami, it makes the happiness of Brahman, of understanding that you're an eternal soul, and understanding that you have nothing to gain and nothing to lose from this material world. The happiness that creates within oneself, of understanding one's eternality, is like a drop in the ocean of Krishna prema, of love for Krishna. It's like one drop, and Krishna prema is like an ocean. So how do we compare a drop to the entire ocean? Well, we can say that the ocean is quite a bit more than the drop of water. And the residents of Vrindavan are so in love with Krishna, they're so captivated by him, and their love for him is so powerful and so focused that he is captivated by them. and he is even controlled by them, the unlimitedly powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's controlled by the love of these, of the residents of Vrindavan. Even the cows, even the calves, he would go to the cows and embrace them, and the fragrance. Has anyone ever known the smell of a cow? You don't know what a cow smells like? Brought up in the city or something? Do you know what a cow smells like? Yeah, what does it smell like? Of course, what it smells like. It smells like a cow. But it has this... What does a cow smell like?
It smells like manure.
But not ordinary old manure, cow manure. But it's very fresh. very earthy. And they breathe. Huh?
Very harmony comforting.
It's very soothing. Next time you see a cow walking down the street, give him a good smell. Or we could start a real fad. There's tree hugging and cow smelling. But Krishna used to, and with the calves, he would take them and he would rub their legs, because their legs are thin, and he would take his forehead and place it against the forehead of the calves. And the calves love Krishna so much, and the cows love Krishna so much, and Krishna loved them so much. Krishna and the other members of the Gokul community, they weren't cattle ranchers. They weren't members of the dairy industry. They were Goraks, so they were cow protectors, and they loved the cows. And even with a little milking, when Krishna would come back after herding the cows, even just with a little effort, the cows would give so much milk. because the milk is the affection, the liquefied affection of the cow. And the cow's milk is, in India, when they milk the cows, they always bring the calves in front of the cows, because as soon as the cow sees the cow drops the milk into her udder and then you can take it out. They let the calf drink a little bit, but by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, if the calf drank all the milk that the cow had, the calf would get sick, because the cow gives so much more milk, because the rest of the milk, by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, is meant for humans. So the cow drinks a little milk, then they take the calf away, the calf drinks a little milk, and then the cow herdsmen, they milk. And Krishna would do this. He would take a golden pail and put it between his knees, and he would sit down and would call the cows by their names, and the cowherd boys would be there, and Nanda Maharaj was there. Every night they would have this event of cow milking after they came back from the forest all day long herding the cows. And all day long, the residents in the town, I'm just thinking, when will Krishna come back? When will Krishna? And then Krishna comes back, and he bathes, and he puts on his turban and his proper clothes according to the season, and then he goes out and he milks the cows just for some time. And they bring all the milk goes to Nanda Maharaj. And all the residents of Vrindavan are with Krishna. He's charming everyone. It's the nature of Krishna that whoever he shows affection to, he melts, that person melts. So everyone in Vrindavan is melted. Their hearts are all melted. So, because of this love, he is always awake to transcendental realization. He's living in that realm. Just like when there's affection for someone in this world, we can't stop but thinking about them. So thinking about Krishna because of the intensity of love of a pure devotee is thinking about Krishna. And Krishna and thoughts about Krishna on that level are just the same. Krishna manifests fully in that self. So they're with Krishna. He's always awake to transcendental realization. So there's another word. There's enlightenment, which means the consciousness is fully lightened, and then there's awake, just like the opposite of enlightenment is in darkenment, is when the lights are off in one's consciousness. So similarly, the opposite of when one's consciousness is awake is that he's asleep. And when one's asleep, one's not aware of what reality actually is. So similarly, the awakened state of consciousness is awake to our relationship with Krishna, and the sleeping state of consciousness is when we are unaware of our relationship, the eternal relationship with Krishna. Rather, we imagine ourselves, rather than in relationship to Krishna, we imagine ourselves as in relationship to the body. Now, one relationship is eternal. And if we understand our relationship with Krishna, then we are eternal. And our relationship with Krishna is eternal. He's eternal, we're eternal, and the relationship is eternal. But if we consider ourselves or conceive of ourselves only in relationship to our body, then our relationship with the body doesn't go on eternally. It goes on as long as the body is alive. And does anyone's body in this world live eternally? No, someone can live for an hour, or 2 hours, or a week, or a month, or a year, or 10 years, or 20 years, or 50 years, or 100 years, or even someone can live to be 130 years old, or 40 years old, maybe even there, maybe, I don't know how old the oldest person in the world is now, but no one lives and lives and lives and lives and lives eternally in a material body. So by investing our sense of self in our material body, then we are doomed to lose, because the body, the relationship between the body and the self is temporary. Clearly it's temporary. So more about this type of a pure soul who's enlightened and awake. He's always awake to transcendental realization. He's living in that. Deki taramuti savatra hoya nija ishta deva spurti. Wherever he looks, he sees everything in relationship as a manifestation of his ishtadeva, his transcendental lord. Such a person, so he, because he knows that Krishna consciousness is the basis of knowledge and action, he sees everything connected with Krishna. Such a person is able to chant, that's such an interesting concept, because he knows that Krishna consciousness is the basis of knowledge and action. Is it clear what that means? It's not a simple sentence to understand. What does it mean to know that Krishna consciousness is the basis of knowledge? That basis means, like say, the book is resting. It's resting on this table. And the table is resting on the carpet, and the carpet is resting on the what's underneath the carpet?
Underlay.
And what's underneath that?
Cement.
And what's underneath the cement?
Sand.
What's underneath the sand?
Water.
Water?
Yeah.
Water?
Yeah.
You mean where all this was sitting here on water ultimately?
Yeah.
Oh no. I should have brought my bathing suit. So I was about to say that we're all resting, the basis of everything is the earth, but now I understand it's water. I don't feel quite as secure as I did 5 minutes ago.
Isn't that rock surrounding the water?
Oh, phew. Thank Thank you. So the basis, the thing that all knowledge rests upon is Krishna, because that's Krishna is the basis of all knowledge. Everything, all knowledge rests upon him. Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Uddhava Gita, Amirapona Lavayu Kamana Buddha Evita, Hankarite Ame, Bina Prakriti, all the material energies are his, they're his energies. They're all his potencies. Otherwise, we can say, well, where did it come from then? We can do the same thing. Okay, this table came from trees. And where did the trees come from? And the trees came from the earth. And where did the earth come from? Well, it's the water and the seeds and the sunlight and everything. Well, where did the water and the seeds and the sunlight come from? And you get back and the scientists conclude that it came from a black hole. Now, I mean, that's not a very satisfying answer. If you believe in black holes, you might as well believe in God. I mean, it's just, because neither of them are very understandable to the material intelligence. I mean, it all came. First, there was a singularity, and the singularity, it's an infinitely dense point, but it's not a point. It doesn't have any dimensions. And I mean, again, it takes faith. So the basis of knowledge is Krishna, and also the basis of action, because he knows that Krishna consciousness is the basis of knowledge and action, because he knows that he knows his knowings that he's an eternal servant of Krishna, and he knows that because he's an eternal servant of Krishna, his actions should be done for Krishna's pleasure. So therefore, Krishna is the basis of knowledge and action. And he sees everything connected with Krishna naturally. If he has those realizations, if he actually sees in that way, then he'll see everything connected with Krishna. Such a person is able to chant the holy name perfectly. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean to chant the holy name perfectly? Okay, well, someone can say what it means to not chant imperfectly. So one couldn't argue with that, the truth of that. What does it mean to chant perfectly?
Full concentration.
Yes, that's part of it. Yes. And that brings, what is the type of chanting called when one chants free from the 10 offenses?
Suranam.
No. Means that's namabhas. This is namaparad, chanting with the offenses, and when one chants without the offenses, that's called offenseless chanting. And the result of offenseless chanting is liberation. But that's not perfect chanting, because there's more that the holy name can give us, and that is Sudanam, is Krishna's love for Krishna. Chanting Sudanam with great attachment for Krishna, it calls Krishna to manifest himself and the whole love for Krishna. So he chants perfectly with love for Krishna, because he's seeing everything in relationship with Krishna. Such a Mahabhagavata, or Bhagavat Pradhan, or great devotee, such a Mahabhagavata Vaishnava has the transcendental eyes to see who is sleeping under the spell of Maya. He can see. One time, I never found a reference for it, but I think maybe Zagatini Masaji told me this. I don't know if you told it to me, maybe you can say where you got it from. Someone asked Prabhupada, well, when you go to like a place like an airport, what do you see? What do you see? I mean, you see transatlantic mountains and departure landers and well-dressed people. on the move, going here and there. And Prabhupada replied, I see so many dead, flapping bodies. Flapping dead bodies. Which means they're dead, in fact, but they're giving the movements as if they were alive. So, when one is awake, alive in Krishna consciousness, one sees the talking of others and the actions of others as nonsense, basically. There's no content, there's no life in it, it's just coming out of their mouths. So he sees that. He sees everyone is actually asleep. As he's awake, he sees people that are asleep. Everyone is asleep, practically, to their eternal identity. So such a Bhagavat has the transcendental eyes to see who's sleeping under the spell of Maya, enchanted by illusion. And he engages himself in awakening sleeping conditioned souls by spreading the knowledge of Krishna consciousness. He opens eyes that are closed by forgetfulness of Krishna. When one's eyes are closed, there's a difference on some level between, okay, if one's in a completely dark room and one's eyes are closed, then what happens when one opens one's eyes? What's the difference? Not very much. But if one is in a light room and there's so many things going on and one's eyes are closed, one may be thinking that everything is dark. But actually, everything isn't dark. There are things that exist outside. One may even be thinking, if one keeps one's eyes closed, that there's nothing here. You walk into a room, you keep your eyes closed, and you say, this room is empty. There's nothing in it. There's nothing in it. It's all nothingness. But what you're seeing doesn't really have anything to do with what's externally existent, existing external to your eyes. It just has to do with the fact that your eyes are open. And if you just open your eyes, then you see, oh, there's a whole world out there, and the world has form and has color. There are people, they're doing things. So he's opening eyes. This is what the work of someone whose eyes himself are opened. He opens eyes that are closed by forgetfulness of Krishna. Thus the living entity is liberated from the dullness of material energy and is fully engaged in the service of the Lord. Why is Prabhupada use this term, the living entity is liberated from the dullness of material energy? What does that mean? Why is material energy dull?
Dead.
It's dead. In what sense is it dead?
It's not alive.
Yeah. The dullness of material energy. Yes. So if we identify with the material energy, with the objects of this world, including our body, our consciousness is dull. So when you, the opposite of dull, when you think of a knife, is sharp. So when someone has dull consciousness, the difference between having dull consciousness and referring to consciousness, the opposite, is sharp. So what would you say is the difference between dull consciousness and sharp consciousness? If someone has dull intelligence or sharp intelligence, what would be the difference?
Can think quickly.
Quickly. And when you say someone has sharp intelligence, he immediately understands the situation.
And can understand the elements involved in the circumstance.
He knows what's going on.
He's aware.
He's perceiving what's actually there. And a person with dull consciousness, he's standing on the train tracks, and the train is about to come, And he's thinking, and it's starting to rumble. You know, the ground is starting to move, and he hears a whistle, and he says, maybe I should take some rest, because it sounds like, well, who knows what he'll say. But he doesn't perceive the danger. He doesn't perceive actually what's there. So it's like when you first get up in the morning or something, is your consciousness dull or sharp? I don't want to pry into your personal life, but it takes a while before the consciousness wakes up. So that's dull and sharp. So the living entity is liberated from the dullness of material energy. The material energy dulls us into not understanding reality accurately. And is so, thus the living entity is liberated when his eyes are opened by this great devotee. He is liberated from the dullness of material energy, and he's engaged fully in the service of the Lord. So instead of trying to get pleasure from the material energy, trying to squeeze pleasure from the material energy. I mean, what you can think of, what's the main thing in the material world that people try to squeeze pleasure from? I mean, not just the object, not the, we say the body, your own body, that's the soul, with its senses trying to get pleasure from it. So if we think that the body is meant for pleasure, now think of a part of your body, like your knee or your hand or your one finger. Now how much pleasure, eyes or nose, how much pleasure can you get from your eyes? Now think of how much pain you can get from your eyes. I mean, I don't want to make it too gross, but you can take a nail or something and stick it in your eye. I mean, or boiling hot peanut butter. No, that doesn't work, does it? I'm just trying to not say something that would terrify everyone, and we all have nightmares tonight. But how much pleasure can you get from your body? And how much pain can you get from your body? So it's clear that the amount of pain that the body is able to deliver is far more than the amount of pleasure it's able to deliver. So the material energy dulls us into thinking that we can get pleasure from the material world, when actually what we end up with is frustration, because we're looking in the wrong place for our pleasure. And especially as the body ages. So Vya Prabhupada described the first class devotee. Now he's going to describe the Madhyam Adhikari, the middle devotee. The Madhyam Adhikari Vaishnava can awaken others to Krishna consciousness and engage them in duties whereby they can advance. It is therefore said in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lokate yavat sparshi hema nahi kore, tavat sparsha mani keha chinite na pore. One cannot understand the value of a touchstone until it turns iron into gold. One should judge by action, not by promises. A Mahabhagavata can turn a living entity from abominable material life to the Lord's service. This is the test of a Mahabhagavata. Although preaching is not meant for a Mahabhagavata can descend to the platform of Madhyam Bhagavata just to convert others to Vaishnavism. Actually, a Mahabhagavata is fit to spread Krishna consciousness, but he does not distinguish where Krishna consciousness should be spread from where it should not. He thinks that everyone is competent to accept Krishna consciousness if the chance is provided. A neophyte and intermediate devotee should always be anxious to hear the Mahabhagavata and serve him in every respect. The neophyte and intermediate devotees can gradually rise to the platform of Uttama Adhikari and become first-class devotees. Symptoms of a first-class devotee are given in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.2.45 Sava Bhuteshu Yapashyad Bhagavat Bhavamatmana Bhutani Bhagavat Yatmani Esha Bhagavata Uttama. When teaching Sanatana Goswami, the Lord further said, Shastra Yukte Sunipuna Dhrida Shraddha Yandra Uttama Arikari Se Tareye Samsara. If one is expert in Vedic literature and has full faith in the Supreme Lord, then he is an Uttama Arikari, a first-class devotee, first-class Vaishnava, a topmost Vaishnava who can deliver the whole world and turn everyone to Krishna consciousness. With great love and affection, the Mahabhagavata observes the Supreme Personality of Godhead, devotional service, and the devotee. He observes nothing beyond Krishna. What does that mean? Because Prabhupada is trying to describe the vision, the great devotee, one who has developed his love for Krishna, what he actually sees, what is through his consciousness. So he says he sees nothing, he observes nothing beyond Krishna. What does that mean?
He sees everything in relation to Krishna.
Yeah. For example.
He see a person, Krishna is there, he see the trees, he see the houses, his energy, his material energy.
But it doesn't go just through his intelligence in the sense of, yeah, that's correct. Like he says, oh, I'm looking at the ocean. And this is Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that the ocean is abundance of water in the ocean. So he just sees everything. Somehow or another he sees it. Because it's love. So when one loves someone else, you're walking in a place and you think, oh, I remember when I used to walk with my beloved here. Or, oh, here's a flower. Wouldn't it be nice to give this flower to my beloved and look at the ocean? Oh, just my beloved. See, just naturally you see everything in relationship. It's just natural when there is full love. So, this is why Uttama Bhagavata, he sees everything in relationship with Krishna. And he understands everything is Krishna's energy. Because when we look at the world, everything in the world must be. If we have an enjoying spirit, we look at the tree and we think, that would be so nice if I could have a tree like that in my house. When I look at a beautiful house, I think of, I really like big beautiful house like that, or a fast car, or I really don't like this one, I'd like that, and the ocean is like this, and I wonder how cold it was, I wouldn't want to go swim. I'm the center of everything. So I'm seeing everything in relationship to me and my capacity to enjoy it and exploit it in that sense. So these Uttama Bhagavatas, they see everything as Krishna's and meant to be used in Krishna's service. Everything is Krishna's. Meant to be used in Krishna's service. Nothing is exempt from that. Because there is nothing. Krishna means the absolute truth. I mean, it's such an amazing concept that he's the absolute truth. What does that mean? It means that there's that all in existence rests upon him. There's nothing outside of him in existence. Nothing is that he's the source of creation, he's the source of maintenance, he's the source of destruction. And it's just amazing. And you think he's the source of creation, he's the source of maintenance, he's the source of destruction. I mean, why do all three? Why create something and maintain it when you can just destroy it? I mean, if you think about these things, it's all quite It's quite interesting and quite puzzling. And that's what it means. The absolute truth is very puzzling. It means that we can't fully conceive of him because we're so tiny and finite. And he's complete and absolute. And his existence and his potencies are everywhere. And there's nothing external to him. So the air is not outside of his existence. We are not outside of his existence because where did we come from? Oh, we can say we came from our parents. But where did the soul, where did we, the living force, come from? Well, we don't know. Well, that's, where did the bodies come from and why? And these are all has to do with Krishna, the answer to these questions. So his influence is everywhere and everything. Why do bodies get old? Because they do. But why? Why do they? So there's some force of nature that causes things to deteriorate. So who is enforcing that? The fact that there are laws of nature that are so uniformly enforced throughout existence implies that there is a enforcer. And he must be very powerful, because just imagine, if you try to control something and force your will upon something in this world, it's very difficult. Even if you have a small business or something, or a family, very hard to enforce your will upon your small business or your family. You can't even convince your two-year-old child to do what you want, especially when you have a two-year-old child. You can't enforce your will anywhere. Practically speaking, Krishna enforces law on all of existence. And it's not like the scientists can understand why existence does what it does. Or to speak of create and make it, they don't understand how the body works at all, practically speaking. On a certain level, yes, but as soon as you go in deeply, every time you answer a question, you come up with more questions. No one understands what to speak of create the system, but everyone understands that it works in such a miraculous way. But why? And how? And who designed it and everything? So there's nothing external to Krishna. That is the point. So he sees that naturally. He realizes it's not that it's intellectual now. He's not thinking sometimes, yes, maybe, no. But he knows. And so his vision is that everyone is serving Krishna. This is the greatest devotee. Because everyone is either serving Krishna's Maya directly, because we can't avoid being servants, or we're serving Krishna directly, consciously, willingly. So he sees that everyone is serving Krishna, so he generally, the Mahabhagavata devotee doesn't preach. Because he just sees everyone is a great devotee, except for me. I'm the only one who's not a great devotee. I have no love for Krishna. So it takes the Madhyam devotee, because the Madhyam devotee sees four different things. He sees the Lord, he sees the devotee, he sees the innocent people, and he sees the inimical people, and he treats them all differently. So the great devotee who sees everything in relationship to Krishna's service, he has to act as if he's on the Madhyam platform if he's going to preach. But when he does that, he's extremely powerful. Because he's not a Madhyam devotee, he's an Uttama devotee. So even though his potency comes out in a Madhyam form, and he's powerful for that reason. So the question that he was answering, a first class Vaishnava is he whose very presence makes others chant the holy name of Lord. So that's the manifestation of a first class Vaishnava in perhaps acting as a madhyam or something, especially, or even as uttama, topmost, that his presence, as soon as they see him, there's something about him, some energy. Have you had that experience that different people have different energies that affect your consciousness differently? Do you sometimes go into, you meet someone and immediately you don't like them? Or sometimes immediately you like a person. How do you deal with that if you're a doctor or something and immediately someone comes and you don't like them? You just have to
put a wall.
You have to see on a different level. Do you have that experience, Krishnalila? Sometimes some people's energy are very, like, you have to deal with all kinds of interesting people.
Every day.
So the Uttama Bhagavata, Mahabhagavata, Mahaprabhu is saying, has such an energy about him that as soon as you see him, you want to chant Krishna's names. It emanates from him, that potency, that love for Krishna causes that. Then, in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed different types of Vaishnavas. So he explained the Vaishnava, the Vaishnatara, and the Vaishnavatama, the topmost, middle, and lower grade Vaishnavas. He thus successively explained all the symptoms of a Vaishnava to the inhabitants of Kalinagram. So they were talking, and in the next chapter, I think they'll have more discussions and more details. There's so much details that the interactions between Mahaprabhu and his devotees were very sweet. He would speak about them so sweetly and say what was really in their heart, and they would feel so humble, and they would have different exchanges. Finally, all the Vaishnavas returned to Bengal. But that year, Pundarik Vidyanidhi remained in Jagannath Puri. Srup Damara Goswami and Pundarik Vidyanidhi had a friendly, intimate relationship because they were both old. As far as discussing topics about discussing Krishna Katha, they were situated on the same platform. This is such an interesting chapter. Pundarik Vidyanidhi initiated Gadadhar Pandit for the second time. And on the day of the Odana Shasti, he saw the festival. The Odana Shasti, here's Prabhupada's explanation. At the beginning of winter, there's a ceremony known as Odana Shasti. This ceremony indicates that from that day forward, a winter covering should be given to Lord Jagannath. That covering is directly purchased from a weaver. According to the Archana Mag, according to the general rules when you're doing worshipping the Lord in the form of a deity, when you buy the cloth from a cloth shop, it should be washed to remove all the starch, and then it can be used to cover the Lord. Pundarik Vidyanidhi saw that the priest neglected to wash the cloth before covering Lord Jagannath. And since he wanted to find some fault in the devotees, he became indignant. What does indignant mean? Became angry. But there's a little more than angry in it. There's a little bit of self-righteous anger. It means, how dare they do something like that? Don't they know? There's a little bit of pride in indignant that may not be there, just in anger. So he became a little pridefully angry. Now, when Pundarik Vidyaniti saw that Lord Jagannath was given a starched garment, he became a little hateful. That's the actual word here, sagrina. In this way, his mind was polluted. So it's interesting, isn't it, that you could see something wrong, and how that you could see something you think is wrong, and there are different ways you could see what you think is wrong. So one way there could be pride in it, there could be anger in it, there could be hatefulness, and also there could be, I don't think this is correct, and let me do something for the betterment, and I should bring it to the attention of someone. So even when dealing with something that's incorrect, one that we think is incorrect, because sometimes we think something is incorrect and then we hear the reasons why it's being done, and then we understand that, oh, now I understand why they do it that way. Have you ever had that experience? Yes, no, yes, you find out after that, oh, now I understand why they do it that way. So that night, so he had bad feelings towards the way the priests had offered Lord Jagannath, the pujaris had offered Lord Jagannath the cloth. They hadn't washed it first. When you buy some clothes in a store, before you wear it, will you wash it?
Yes.
No one will admit it now, since everyone's voted in favor of
sometimes.
Huh?
Sometimes.
Okay, the truth comes out. Okay. You have no idea what they did with it, what they poured on it before they soaked it.
Well, they were eating when they were making it.
Yeah, who knows? So, that night, Pundarik Vidyaniti, after thinking like this, went to sleep, and the brothers, Lord Jagannath and Balaram, came to Pundarik Vidyaniti, and smiling, they began to slap him in his dream. So he woke up. And he saw that although he was dreaming, his cheeks were swollen from the slapping. And Pundarik Vidyaniti was very happy within. Now, why was he happy? The incident has been elaborately described by Vrindavan Thakur. So he doesn't describe it here anymore, but he was so happy, he immediately went to Srup Damodar and told him what had happened, and he showed him that his cheeks were swollen, and he was so ecstatic. Why?
Being corrected by the Lord himself.
Yeah. Now, why don't you talk about that? What kind of consciousness it would take, or what was the realization that you feel so happy when you know that Krishna himself is punishing you and slapping you, making your face, and, or any kind of punishment? Why would that make you happy?
How great is your master?
Yes.
He would indicate relationship.
Yeah.
Krishna cares about you.
He cares about you. That he's the Supreme Lord is. He's very busy. I mean, after all, if he didn't make that...